This is Rick Kleffel with a special edition of Narrative Species for Talk of the Bay on a Sunday on KSQT Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, K-Squid 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM. We are streaming online at ksqt.org. First, we'll hear from Vice President and Presidential Candidate Kamala Harris about her book, Smart on Crime, A Career Prosecutor's Plan to Make Us Safer. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from Nobel Prize winner and interim Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Muhammad Yunus, about his book, A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon Emissions. We start with Kamala Harris discussing her book, Smart on Crime.
Kamala Harris is San Francisco's district attorney. She's been named one of Newsweek's 20 most powerful women. Her new book is Smart on Crime, A Career Prosecutor's Plan to Make Us Safer. Thank you for joining me, Kamala.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Kamala Harris is San Francisco's district attorney. She's been named one of Newsweek's 20 most powerful women. Her new book is Smart on Crime, A Career Prosecutor's Plan to Make Us Safer. Thank you for joining me, Kamala.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Kamala, your book starts out with a little sketch of who you are, and I think that's important as to how you developed your smart on crime theory. So give us an idea of who you are.
Well, I am one of two daughters of parents who met when they were graduate students at the University of California, Berkeley in the 1960s. And they met when they were both active in the civil rights movement. And so I'm one of those people who grew up surrounded by adults who pretty much spent full time marching and shouting about that thing called justice. And so for me, the heroes of that important civil rights movement were the lawyers. And that was Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston and Constance Baker Motley. And they were using the skill of the great profession of law to translate the passion in the streets into the courtrooms of our country. And frankly, reminding all of those people who needed to be reminded of that great promise we articulated in 1776, which is, of course, that we're all and should be treated as equals. So that's who I am, and that's why I wanted to become a lawyer. At a very young age, I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I went on to Howard University in Washington, D.C., and then came back home to California and attended Hastings College of the Law, and straight out of law school, made the decision that I thought that my fight for the pursuit of justice could be and should be as a prosecutor. And so I went to the Alameda County DA's office, which, as an aside, I'll tell you, was considered to be one of the best DA's offices in the country at the time. And in large part, the reputation came from the fact that years before, the elected DA of Alameda County was Earl Warren, who, of course, was the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court and the author of Brown versus Board of Education. And back to who I am, I'll tell you that I'm part of the second class to integrate Berkeley Public Schools. So the fact that I was years later working in the office of the man who had authored that decision is you know, there's a certain symmetry about that I enjoy.
That's understandable. Now, you make a really interesting statement at the beginning of this book that I think is the theme of the book, which is that safety is a civil right.
Absolutely. You know, when we think about those things that are, you know, fundamental to a productive and a happy existence, you know, there it is true. So obviously equality is essential. We must be seen and treated as equals, and we should strive for a society that treats everyone as equals. I think that education should be seen in the same light as a basic civil right, and safety. If people are living in a state of fear in a community where they don't trust their neighbors or they don't feel that they can hold on to their property without it being vandalized, then they're in a constant state of panic and concern, and chaos naturally evolves from that environment. So when I talk about safety as a basic civil right, I believe that we should, as a society and certainly as a country, commit ourselves as we do to any other basic civil right to this issue and notion that all communities must be safe and the people in those communities must live in a way that they feel safe.
That's a distinction you make. That's an interesting one. The distinction between feeling safe and being safe. Not always congruent, are they?
That's correct. And exactly. And we could go into a whole different conversation, to your point, on the opposite of that, right? Which is the fear issue.
Mm-hmm.
Fear based on perception.
Mm-hmm.
That is based on reality or is based on perception, you know, because of whatever is being thrown out in the environment that mm-hmm. causes people to have a sense of fear, even though they're in no actual danger.
You also talk in the beginning about economics and crime, and you've done a great deal to apply the principle of economics to fight crime, which I think is a great approach.
I think, Rick, that we are in a society, government in particular, it has become in many ways obsolete. Okay, so how's that for a controversial statement that everyone probably agrees with? You be controversial and everyone agrees with you at the same time? I think government is obsolete to a large degree, and I think law enforcement and the way that we do our work can be considered obsolete when you put it in the perspective of measuring success. And have we built into the system, have we built into the way we do business metrics,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which then would force us to look at our productivity and our processes in a way that questions the cost-benefit, right, of mm-hmm. the system, and
sure.
also that just measures success, period. You know, my mother was a scientist, and she taught us and she thought often of her work by way of thinking about, you know, posing a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then testing it out. And if it didn't work, go back, reorder the hypothetical, right?
Sure.
Change the variables and then test it out again. But not defend the first decision just because you did it that way.
Right.
Even if it didn't work.
Yeah.
And I think that when it comes to the criminal justice system, in particular in California, the numbers aren't working.
No,
okay, it's just
not
working. You know, on an annual basis, we release 120,000 prisoners in California because they've served their time. Within 3 years of their release, 70% reoffend, 70% recidivate. It's the highest recidivism rate in the country.
Really?
I would tell you that if this were a private business,
fired.
If this were a public institution, a medical institution, absolutely, the Board of Trustees would shut it down.
Right. Your book is divided into two parts. But actually, let's talk a little bit about something that you've done here called the Back on Track program.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit, what is Back on Track?
So Back on Track is a reentry initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And reentry is a criminal justice concept that asks us to focus on known offenders who are re-entering the community after they have been held accountable for their crime. And so that gets to the recidivism issue, right? Which
sure.
is that we know that 70% of known offenders will re-offend. So instead of closing our eyes to that fact, let's actually see it for what it is. Let's build a system up around the idea that they need to be held accountable. They need to go to jail if that's what the crime calls for. But that they're all coming out, a lot of them are, and let's have a plan for how we're going to re-enter them so they don't do what is predictable, which is re-offend and then, you know, become part of that revolving door of crime. So reentry initiative in San Francisco that we created, Back on Track. I chose to focus on the 18 through 24-year-old first-time low-level drug sales offender who is involved in nonviolent crime. So why 18 through 24-year-old focus? Well, when I was at Howard University, when we were in college, we were 18 through 24, and we were called college kids.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
But when you turn 18 and you're in the system, you're considered to be an adult, period,
mm-hmm.
without any regard to the fact that that's the very phase of life in which we have invested billions of dollars in this world in places called colleges and universities,
mm-hmm.
knowing that's the prime phase of life during which we mold and shape and direct a human being to become a productive adult. So we focused on that age range predominantly and basically brought on board the business community, Chamber of Commerce, brought on board the labor unions, in particular building trades, plumbers, carpenters, and then also brought on board our nonprofit community-based groups. And we addressed the fact that for this first-time low-level nonviolent drug sales offender, most of them needed to get a high school equivalency degree and be enrolled in City College. Almost none of them had employable skills, so we asked our friends at the carpenters and the plumbers unions, would you enroll them in your pre-apprenticeship programs? We addressed the fact that a lot of them are parents who have a natural desire to parent their child,
sure,
but not necessarily the skills.
And also it makes them more stable, too.
Absolutely. And so we brought on board the community groups who could introduce them, you know, introduce these young parents to the PTA and do the things that they naturally would want to do but didn't necessarily have the resources to do. And over the course of this initiative Back on Track, we have reduced the recidivism or reoffense rate for this population from 54% to less than 10%. It's been so successful that the National DA's Association chose it as a model for DA's offices around the country. And then last month, the United States Department of Justice posted it on their website as an example of innovation in law enforcement for the country. And then we actually wrote a bill, and Speaker Karen Bass sponsored it, and we took it up to Sacramento. And Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed our bill.
He really did,
making Back on Track a model for the state. Mm-hmm. And this gets to one of the other points I make in the book, and to the point of your reaction to that. I really, as a career prosecutor, I really absolutely believe that there are certain issues, to be sure, that are partisan, some are bipartisan, but some are nonpartisan. And crime has to be seen as a nonpartisan issue, right? Which is that we all want to be safe.
Sure.
Everybody does. I don't know of any robber that approached a victim and first asked, well, are you a Democrat or a Republican, right?
No.
It's not happening that way.
No.
And so we all want to be safe. We all want to know that we are using limited government resources in a way that is most efficient. We all want to believe that we are going to have a society that will break down silos and actually instead collaborate around collective concerns. And the issue in particular of recidivism among nonviolent offenders is a very big issue when we look objectively at what's occupying our criminal justice system.
And it gets to the economic aspects, too.
Absolutely.
It costs a boatload of money to keep these people in jail. It's insane.
It's insane. But here's the point that I have to make and articulate. I am not saying that people should not be held accountable for their crime. They should.
Mm-hmm.
You commit a crime, you need to be held accountable. There's a reason we have laws and rules. And one of them is that we just, you know, you just can't do anything you feel like doing. You know, my mother used to have this saying. And she'd say, well, you know, Kamala, there may be 100 reasons why one man kills another man. But the man's still dead, right? Right,
yeah.
This is the woman who raised me, or the civil rights activist. But that's what she said. And her point was, you know, at some point we can talk about the reasons and we can even put them in the context of excuses or explanations. But fact is fact. And if someone commits a crime, they should be held accountable. But after they have been held accountable, mm-hmm. we should also recognize that we've got to figure out a way to integrate them back into our society and do it in a way that diminishes the likelihood that they'll commit another crime. And that's the premise behind a lot of the work that I've done, not only around the Reentry Initiative Back on Track, but also looking, for example, at an issue that many people might think is a small, insignificant issue, such as truancy among elementary school students, right?
Really? Now that's interesting.
Well, so here's how it came about. I did an assessment of who the homicide victims were in San Francisco who were under the age of 25 when they were killed, and learned that 94% of them were high school dropouts.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went over to the school district, and I learned that of the students who had been designated as habitually and chronically truant, 40% are elementary school students.
Really?
Yeah. Yes, and when I'm saying habitually and chronically truant, I'm not talking about missing a couple of days. I'm talking about up to 60 to 80 days of unexcused absences out of a 180-day school year.
That's significant. And again, that's an economic significance to that, because if the kids are going to school, the parents are able to work, there are more productive parts of the community. It's a feedback loop.
To your very point, just last month, the University of California, Santa Barbara, UCSB, issued a study, and they have shown that the cost to California of truancy, the direct cost, is $1.1 billion, yes, with a B as in boy, billion dollars a year. And the residual cost in terms of the cost to the larger social services structure is in the double-digit billions. It's actually costing us a lot of money to have these elementary school students miss so much school. And, you know, and as a career prosecutor who's also prosecuted child abuse cases, I'll tell you that there are many reasons we want our children to be in school. Mm-hmm. And one of them that may not be so obvious is that it's in school, often in elementary school, that we learn of the child. We figure out that, oh, little Johnny is not unable to learn, he just needs glasses.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. That.
Or, you know, Sally is not a discipline problem, she actually needs a hearing aid. Mm-hmm. Right?
Sure.
Or we learn that a child is being abused or neglected. And it's at the early stage of life that we want to deal with these issues.
Yeah, because it's easier to correct, give some kid a lunch than it is to put him in jail for 6 years.
Absolutely. And you know, and people say sometimes, well, maybe because she's a woman that she cares about an issue like truancy. No. The fact is that I think that we have as a society marginalized the significance of addressing issues impacting children. And we've decided in some ways, oh, that's the small issue. If you want to take on big issues, you take on something else. You are concerned about children because they're cute and cuddly. When in fact...
I've got two kids. They ain't cute.
Yeah. Are they teenagers?
Yeah.
But the fact is, I'm looking at that six-year-old not because they're cute and cuddly, but because I'm looking at who that child will be in just about 10 years if we don't address that six-year-old's issues right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you, you and everybody else will be knocking on my door as DA when that 16-year-old is a menace to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
sure.
going to cost us a lot more. My reentry initiative, back on track, okay? It cost me $10,000 every time I prosecute a felony. It cost us about $35,000 a year to house somebody in the county jail, $49,000 a year to house someone in the state prison. Back on track as an initiative costs less than $5,000 per participant. So on the money alone, it makes sense. Let's bring up another significant economic issue for our country, workforce development.
Mm.
I mean, and then talk about the wasted human capital.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, there are only so many Starbucks and McDonald's there can be in this country. And that's not the kind of employment we want to build. We want to build a skilled workforce that'll produce
stuff that will be
able to export.
That's right.
We're listening to Kamala Harris discuss her book, Smart on Crime. This is Rick Clevel, host of Narrative Species for Talk of the Bay on KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQD Prunedale, KSQD 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM. We are streaming online at ksqd.org.
Significant. And again, that's an economic significance to that, because if the kids are going to school, the parents are able to work, there are more productive parts of the community. It's a feedback loop.
To your very point, just last month, the University of California, Santa Barbara, UCSB, issued a study, and they have shown that the cost to California of truancy, the direct cost, is $1.1 billion, yes, with a B as in boy, $1 billion a year. And the residual cost in terms of the cost to the larger social services structure is in the double-digit billions. It's actually costing us a lot of money to have these elementary school students miss so much school. And, you know, and as a career prosecutor who's also prosecuted child abuse cases, I'll tell you that there are many reasons we want our children to be in school.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them that may not be so obvious is that it's in school, often in elementary school, that we learn of the child. We figure out that, oh, little Johnny is not unable to learn, he just needs glasses.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. That.
Or, you know, Sally is not a discipline problem, she actually needs a hearing aid.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
Or we learn that a child is being abused or neglected. And it's at the early stage of life that we want to deal with these issues.
Yeah, because it's easier to correct, give some kid a lunch than it is to put him in jail for 6 years.
Absolutely. And you know, and people say sometimes, well, maybe because she's a woman that she cares about an issue like truancy. No. The fact is that I think that we have as a society marginalized the significance of addressing issues impacting children. And we've decided in some ways, oh, that's the small issue. If you want to take on big issues, you take on something else. You are concerned about children because they're cute and cuddly. When in fact...
I've got two kids. They ain't cute.
Yeah. Are they teenagers?
Yeah.
But the fact is, I'm looking at that six-year-old not because... they're cute and cuddly, but because I'm looking at who that child will be in just about 10 years if we don't address that six-year-old's issues right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you, you and everybody else will be knocking on my door as DA when that 16-year-old is a menace to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to cost us a lot more. My reentry initiative, back on track, okay? It cost me $10,000 every time I prosecute a felony. It cost us about $35,000 a year to house somebody in the county jail, $49,000 a year to house someone in the state prison. Back on track as an initiative costs less than $5,000 per participant. So on the money alone, it makes sense. Let's bring up another significant economic issue for our country, workforce development.
Mm.
I mean, and then talk about the wasted human capital.
Sure.
Right?
I mean... there are only so many Starbucks and McDonald's there can be in this country. And that's not the kind of employment we want to build. We want to build a skilled workforce that will produce
stuff that will be
able to export.
That's right.
Now, one thing I want you to talk a little bit about was what you called the crime pyramid. And I think this is a very interesting theory because it kind of gets back to this aspect of putting the efforts where they need to be put.
So I'm glad you raised that. So, okay, in the book, as you pointed out, there are two parts. The first part is basically outlining the myths that I think have caused us to really slow down what could be progress around criminal justice policy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the myths is that all crime is violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand where it comes from, and it's so cliche to attack the media, but I'm going to do that now. But not your show. But here's the reality of it. Most people think they understand the criminal justice system, understandably, because they are surrounded, if not bombarded, by information about the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
It's the front page story on the newspaper. It is the leading story on the evening news. It is the subject of their favorite television series and probably their favorite movie. And you know that there's a saying in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads.
Mm.
Most of the information the general public receives about the criminal justice system suggests that most of the crime in the system is violent crime and sensationally violent crime or horrendous for some reason or another, either because of its peculiarity or because of its viciousness. So the public then has an appetite for criminal justice policy that understandably is, hey, if you're going to talk to me about what's in the criminal justice system, all I want you to do is lock them up for as long as you can.
Sure.
And what I'm asking through this book, Smart on Crime, is that we recognize that, in fact, what's in the criminal justice system can be best understood by thinking of the pyramid. At the top of the pyramid are the most serious crimes. Understandably, they're at the top, they're our priority because they wreak the most damage to the victims in our society. And for those reasons, always a priority. But they're actually the fewest number of crimes. What is occupying all of our resources and time and attention is what's at the middle and the base of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And the low level, and in particular, nonviolent crimes. And I'm simply suggesting that when we see the crime issue on the pyramid, we then I think can easily understand that we cannot have a one-size-fits-all approach to crime.
Like the three strikes law?
Well, you know, I mean, but basically...
That's a one-size-fits-all.
I mean, I'm happy to talk about three strikes, but it is about saying that there's one way to address violent crime, and it is proven that there are other ways to address nonviolent crime with the hope of what we all want, which is that we'll reduce the likelihood that offender will reoffend. And so for nonviolent crime, we have to understand that most of the people who commit those crimes are going to reoffend if we don't intervene. Mm-hmm. It's about recognizing that the public health model that works for a health epidemic is absolutely perfectly suited also to help us with the crime epidemic.
Interesting.
And in particular to realize that, like we know with the health epidemic, first line of attack, prevention. That's why everybody's getting that swine flu shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second line of attack, if we're too late and the sniffles start occurring, early intervention. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that would be like the truancy issue.
Sure.
Early intervention. Let's deal with it right there,
truancy,
right?
Right.
And then, but if we are dealing with an epidemic in the emergency room, we are too late. We are, and it's too expensive. And so the crime pyramid, the public health model, those are all about really, I think, if we see these issues through that lens, you know, mm-hmm. I think that we will be smarter on crime and improve safety in our communities.
Well, let's talk a little bit about three strikes. I mean, there's a lot of talk about people who have been thrown, you know, had the key thrown away, who have hardly had any kind of violent crime and don't even seem like career criminals. Do you think we should repeal three strikes?
First of all, let's remember how three strikes came about.
Mm-hmm.
It was a horrendous, horrible, tragic case involving a young girl by the name of Polly Class.
Sure, sure.
And what was done to her and by extension her family by someone who should have never been free to do it
mm-hmm.
was horrendous. And so the public, all of us, I think, had a very appropriate emotional response to what happened to her, which is, this is outrageous, and when we learned who did it, and we knew he had done things like this in the past, everyone understandably said, well, he did this horrible stuff in the past. How could he have been free to do this to this little girl?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a push based on that appropriate emotion and outrage to say, hey, we need to toughen the laws around known serious and violent offenders who reoffend with a serious and violent crime.
Mm.
But what happened in the way that three strikes was written, both through the legislative process and through the initiative process, the third offense could be any felony, did not require that it was a serious and violent felony.
Right.
And so there were the high-profile cases that involved nonviolent felonies.
Sure, stealing videotapes.
That caused people to be in prison for 25 years to life. My policy in my office is that that last offense has to be serious or violent. It cannot be, for example, a petty theft that would result in a three strikes conviction.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the internet because you mentioned this in the book. The internet has this kind of, for a large segment of the population, the internet is this kind of really terrifying place and idea where cyber stalkers, you know, are luring young children to their doom. It's really just a giant advertising place. And there's a lot of temptation, I think, at this point to restrain our freedom in the sense of safety?
Well, let me understand better what you're asking.
Well, I mean, you say that new kind of laws are needed to deal with the internet. What kind of laws do you think? Because, for example, there's a lot of the media companies, Hollywood in particular, is proposing an idea of a law which is like three strikes. If you're accused, not convicted, if a media company accuses you three times of illegal sharing, they want to cut off your internet forever. Now, this strikes me as putting the courts, your office, in the service of, you know, trolling for people who have late fees.
Sure. So, okay. Couple things. One, I think that we are on the verge, you know, we're very lucky to be living right now, of just changing the way we have all ever existed. And it's because of the rapid growth of technology that is allowing us to communicate in ways we could never communicate before and share information. And, you know, the sociological impact of this technology is just starting to evidence itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're in a new world, and it's exciting. And I would never want to be in a position to hamper or to slow down the development of this technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still very much, history will show, in its infancy stage.
Oh, yes.
So that being said, there is also the reality that this new way of doing business, this new world that is opened up through the web,
mm-hmm.
Is no different than any other world or place. Crimes are happening there also.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to now learn how to do what we have known we needed to do for generations around crime happening on the streets. We have to learn how to do that on the web and adopt and apply the essential skills that we have to keep ourselves safe outside of the web on the web. So what am I talking about? Well, you know, for example, parents have known for generations, teach your child, don't talk to a stranger, watch the light before you cross the street, hold my hand before you cross the street, things like that. We need to now teach parents, in particular, how to teach their children how to be safe on the web.
Mm-hmm.
There's another category of crime that's happening on the web, and that is crimes happening in seniors.
Mm.
You know, again, the technology is so exciting. So seniors, a lot of them, unfortunately, are very isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And the web allows an otherwise isolated person to have constant interactions with other people,
mm-hmm.
as well as to use it as a source of information and entertainment. And unfortunately, though, what I find happening a lot with crimes against seniors is that some person who is not well known to the senior will ingratiate themselves and place themselves in a position of trust with the senior and then take advantage of that relationship, and actually they become a predator and steal from the victim and wreak havoc on their lives. And I see these cases happening through relationships that are built up on the internet. You know, we're basically, both for the children and seniors, the anonymous person becomes familiar,
mm-hmm.
and then the guards let down, and this predator takes advantage of that child or that senior. So these are areas of concern for me, and these are some of the things I talk about in the book. It comes under the context also of, you know, the stranger danger myth,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right?
Not myth, but because there are absolutely dangers from strangers, but the most prevalent issue that I'm seeing in terms of victimization of these types, the predator is someone who puts themselves in a relationship of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And the internet is one tool that allows people to do that in a way that we haven't seen before.
I've been speaking with Kamala Harris. Her new book is Smart on Crime, A Career Prosecutor's Plan to Make Us Safer. Thank you for joining me, Kamala.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
We just heard Kamala Harris discussing her book, Smart on Crime. This is Rick Kleffel, host of Narrative Species for Talk of the Bay on KSQD San Cruz, KSQD Prunedale, KSQD 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM. We are streaming online at ksqd.org. Next, a conversation with Nobel Prize winner and interim Prime Minister for Bangladesh, Muhammad Yunus, about his book, A World of Three Zeros.
I have devoted most of my life to working for the poorest people, particularly the poorest women, trying to remove the hurdles they face in their efforts to improve their lives. To the tool known as microcredit, Grameen Bank, which I launched in my home country of Bangladesh in 1976, makes capital available to poor villagers, especially women. Microcredit has since unleashed the entrepreneurial capabilities of over 300 million poor people around the world, helping to break the chains of poverty and exploitation that have enslaved them.
Muhammad Yunus is a native of Bangladesh, educated at Dhaka University, and was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to study economics at Vanderbilt University. In 1972, he became head of the economics department at Chittagong University. He's the founder of Grameen Bank and father of microcredit, an economic movement that has helped lift millions of families around the world out of poverty. He is also the father of social business. Yunus and Grameen Bank are winners of the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. His books include Banker to the Poor, Creating a World Without Poverty, and Building a Social Business. His new book is A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Carbon Emissions. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Yunus.
Thank you for inviting me.
For me, this book, the thing that stands out is the power of ideas. A single man with a single pragmatic, practical idea, acting in a small part of the world, treating a small number of people, managed to change the entire world, the economic structure of the entire world. This is a huge accomplishment. This lets us know that something that many people think which is impossible, change. It's not only possible, it's achievable by one man with one idea acting locally. So tell me about that, how that felt to make that kind of change and the power of that idea.
At the moment when I was beginning it, I had no idea that I was really changing anything in a big way. I see a problem there in the village that I was trying to help people. And I said, a lot of loan sharking in the village. People lending tiny little money to poor people. And in that pretext, they grab everything the poor person has. And it's just so horrible when you see face to face, so close to the event. So I felt terrible that I cannot do anything to protect those poor people. One idea that came, maybe I can do some help to few people if I start lending money to them instead of they going to the loan shark. It's a very simple thing. I lend the money, telling them they don't have to have any terrible conditionalities of it. As long as they pay me back, that's good enough for me. I didn't know what will be the result. But people liked that idea, started coming to me. And I started taking money out of my pocket and giving loans, a very small amount of loan, $2, $5, $10, that kind of loan. And I was feeling so happy that they liked it because they don't have to go to loan shark and lose everything. And I continued and became bigger and bigger. And I feel happier and happier because I can reach out to more people and the loan shark cannot touch them. And at one point it became so big, I thought I alone with my money cannot go on like this. Sooner or later I'll come to the end of my money. So I was thinking of creating a bank out of it. Started in 1976, we created a bank in 1983, called it Grameen Bank or Village Bank. And that was the beginning. I had no idea that people everywhere will need that kind of support, but it gradually grew within the country. And then we saw same thing happen in other countries. So the people picked up the idea and started doing it there. And now it became a global phenomenon. No country in the world exists without a program like ours called microcredit. Grameen Bank program. Even in the United States, we run Grameen America here. It started in 2008. You have a branch right in San Jose. There are 20 branches all over the United States, one in San Jose and seven in New York City and other Charlotte, North Carolina, in Houston, Boston, and Omaha, Nebraska, and many other places. And we have over 100,000 borrowers, all of them women. Startup loan will be somewhere around $1,000. And they start their business and pay back. No guarantee, no collateral, no papers needed. And repayment rate is near 100%. We have given out nearly $1 billion in loans. And we are hoping in the next 10 years we can give $10 billion to 500,000 borrowers as we keep on expanding from 20 branches today to 40 branches in 10 years. We could do more. If you had access to finance, if you had more money, we can reach out to more people. And it works even in inner cities here, including in the deep villages and mountains and tribal areas everywhere around the world.
You suggest in your new book that one of the things we need to do is to take a look at how we measure growth. Right now we measure growth as GDP, but that's a really flawed vision of what we actually consider growth as human beings. And I think that, so talk about just the import of changing the way we measure what we consider growth, economic growth.
Yeah, because it doesn't make sense to measure growth in GDP terms. It doesn't take care of the economic conditions of all people. If one person has $100 and the rest of us nothing, GDP will tell everybody has $1, whereas 99% or 99 people don't have anything. So it can be very peculiar situation when all the wealth is concentrated in one or two or four hands and rest of the people don't have anything. So if they grow, they say economy is growing. Actually, the idea is not the growth of the economy, it's the idea of growth of the people. So we have to find an indicator. What is the growth of the people? Where are they in general? Today, if you take the global scenario, only 8 people in the whole world have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the population of the entire world, nearly about 4 billion people. So wealth of the 4 billion people equals the wealth of the 8 people. And it's getting worse every day. Tomorrow it will be 4 people owning more wealth than the bottom 50%. And next day, probably one person alone have more wealth than the 50% of the people. So what is the GDP thing here? We are saying our per capita income and such and so on. You're dividing up the wealth of few people by the number of huge population and say this is our per capita income. It doesn't tell us anything. It doesn't tell us that all this wealth is concentrated in few hands. If you go in a Broadway, you'll say 1% of the population of the world own 99% of the wealth of the world. So you put it in a reverse way, 99% of the population of the world own only 1% of the total wealth of the world. So you're distributing it, that 1% to the 99%. Then you know what is the picture, because those 1% has nothing to do with all these people. So that way I would say it's not a good indicator to understand what is happening in the life and the quality of the people of the country.
You know, one of the things that interested me was that your notion that the very premise of capitalism is flawed, because you say that it mentions human beings, and this is analogous to your what you were just saying about GDP. It only mentions human beings as its only notion is that human beings only want to acquire more stuff.
That's right.
Human beings have a lot more things on their mind than just getting more stuff, don't they?
Yeah, that's a very wrong way of visualizing what a human being is. In a capitalist theory, it says human being is driven by self-interest. So they're all interested in themselves, each one of them. I said that's a very narrow view of human being. Human being is selfish, yes, but at the same time, they're enormously selfless. And that's what the human being is all about. They're not trying to make everything for themselves. They need something for themselves, but they're also interested in the rest of the world. What happens to other people, what happens to the planet, what happens to children, etc., etc. But that is not taken care of in the economic theory. So I said, why don't we include both sides of human being, selfishness and selflessness, and design the business world based on selfishness, based on selflessness. Today, that selflessness is not allowed to play within the economic world. They said business is business, meaning that you don't consider anything else except for making money. So you have only dollar signs in your eyes. With dollar signs in your eyes, you don't see anything else. So you look like you are such a generous person, but since theory has put all the dollar signs, your eyes are now designed in a way you only catch the signals from the dollars, nothing else. I said that's what ruined the whole economy. Once you accept human being as a multidimensional, selfish and selfless, then suddenly the world becomes a very friendly place that you can solve all the problems of the world by designing business by yourself. You don't have to wait for anybody to come and do it for you. So that's what I'm trying to encourage, because I've been doing it all my life, creating those social businesses to solve the problem. And microcredit is one of them. I didn't design microcredit to make myself rich. I didn't own any single share of the bank. So I designed it to be owned by the borrowers themselves. So a huge bank with the 9 million borrowers right now in Bangladesh, and it's owned by the borrowers. They sit in the board, they make the decision. I only help them to design and run it on their behalf. That's what I did. And I created many other companies, energy companies, telecom companies, and companies for healthcare. And everywhere, the idea is I don't want to make money from them. I want to solve the people's problem in healthcare, in communication, and renewable energy, and so on and so forth. And that's what we call social business. And we define it by saying it's a business to solve problems rather than make money. The present businesses are always designed to make money. The more money you make, more successful you are. Profit maximization is the key to the whole success of the economy. That's what we are told in our business classes. I said, no, we can design business to solve problem without having any intention of taking one penny as a profit. As an investor, I can take back the investment money, nothing more than that. Whatever profit the company makes is plowed back into the company, because the whole target of the company, objective of the company, is to solve problem. Now, once we accept it, once we teach it in our classrooms, children know about it, that there are two kinds of business to make money, business to solve problems. Then they will grow up to know what kind of business I would like to do. Should I be running a business to make money for myself, or make money for somebody else? Or should I be with the business to solve people's problem? And I get my salary, but that's all I need, and I can have a nice life with my salary, but I'm dedicating this whole business to solve people's problem. In the process, I can solve all the problems in the world.
I think this is such a wonderful idea, because it just moves on just redefining and opening up our vision. We have this idea, again, from classical capitalism, that it's a zero-sum game, that there are winners and there are losers, and if you're a winner, then somebody else is a loser, and if you're a loser, then that's because somebody else has been a winner. That's not the actual way things have to work in the real world. And I think one of the things I really like about your approach, especially with social business, is that it's very pragmatic. It's, here is a problem. We do not, and you have so many wonderful examples in your book, we don't have enough clean water in these villages to drink. And so you form a social business whose goal isn't to make money. Its business is to pay back the investors, keep the people who are performing the duties in enough money to keep their lives solvent, but also to solve this big problem. And I think that's a very interesting approach.
I started with the premise that all human beings are packed with unlimited creative power.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, business world, to make money, use that creativity only for selfish purposes. Not for other purposes, because the other purposes they don't recognize, because in their world, making money is the only purpose of life. I said, we are wasting all our creative energy. You are using only a small part of our creative energy in making money. If we could use our creative energy, all of us, then we can solve all the problems in the world, because no problem can be more than the totality of the human beings. If we bring all our creative power on the table, then we can make all impossibles possible in a social business way, because now we are focusing on solving problems, not kind of anchored with making money for myself. So suddenly I see the dollar signs in my eyes are removed, as if I had glasses with dollar sign. I took off the dollar sign glasses and put on the social business glasses. Suddenly I see lots of opportunities, and my creative energy started shooting up, that this is what you should do, this is what can be done, and in a sustainable way. It's not in a charity way. The charity way, we can do that. But the problem with charity is, it's a good idea. Charity is a wonderful thing that happened to the world. But one limitation of charity is, charity money goes out, does wonderful work, but it doesn't come back. So you have only one-time use of your money. If you design it as a social business to solve the problem, not make money for yourself, then social business money goes out, solves the problem, and comes back entirely, every penny of it, and bring a surplus to. Then you put the money back again. The social business, original investment, and the money that you made plowed back into the business, it grows. So you have multiple use of this, unlimited use of the same money compared to the charity money where only one time use. Now this is endless use. So I said, this is very powerful. If you introduce the idea of social business, if we teach in the classroom, the students will learn that, yes, I can create a business to solve problems. They feel good. They feel emboldened that, yes, I can handle all the problems I see. At least I can start solving a small slice of that problem. Important thing is if you can solve even a small slice of that problem, you have opened the door. Now all one has to do is to repeat it because you came with your creative power to address something which you were never addressed before. So then power comes that you repeat, like microcredit. We did it in a small village with few people. But the fact that it worked, then it becomes possible for repeat it. So we repeat it in other villages, one after another, all over Bangladesh, then it spread all over the world, including United States.
We're listening to Nobel Prize winner and interim Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Muhammad Yunus, discuss his book, A World of Three Zeros. This is Rick Clevel, host of Narrative Species for Talk of the Bay on KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQD Prunedale, KSQD 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM. We're streaming online at ksqd.org.
You talk about, we're talking about the import of technology. That's one of the three superpowers. And I really loved your idea that if we can make things like handheld portable video games and all this stuff where we apply our high tech to luxury gadgets, that same application of technology could go, be redirected towards stuff that makes it possible for people in villages to live at without in comfort and security.
Absolutely. Instead of just frills about life, you do the frills, games, and so on, which you enjoy. But at the same time, that creative power can be applied, that technology can be applied
exactly.
To change the world with healthcare.
Exactly, yes.
Everybody can be having access to healthcare without any trouble because it's just at your fingertip. You don't have to make a trip to your nearest city, your nearest country, which has a better healthcare. You don't have to go anywhere. In your home, you got the entire healthcare, and that healthcare is oriented to prevention, not the cure, because cure is unnecessary.
Sure.
If you can get to the disease, whatever is happening, and slightest change in your body, which starts today, in 10 years' time, it will be a terrible disease at the development. We don't wait the 10 years before it's a complicated disease. We catch him right now. It's a simple thing. All you have to do, add a new food in your diet or just walk a mile or something, have a good sleep or something like that, and it will disappear just like that. And that disease will never develop. So we can have the technology. Now you're talking about artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I said you're talking about artificial intelligence to remove people from the work so that you don't need people to work. I said instead of harming people, I could use artificial intelligence to bring healthcare services to everybody. That intelligence will tell you all the things any doctor can do, and they perform all the operations that any doctor can do. And it will be almost close to costless because it's done in a way it covers the cost because millions and billions of people are involved in it. So the cost factor comes per person is very, very small. So this is also possible provided we guide this thing in from the selfless part of it, our mind and our thinking. If we keep on the selfish part, money-making part, greedy part, then we'll creating things to harm people because we'll create artificial intelligence so that I don't have to hire people. If I don't hire people, where do they go? Who's taking care of them?
They're going to be in the unemployment line. They're going to be on my front lawn wanting whatever I have and with good reason. You know, this brings us to the third pillar of transforming the world, good governments and human rights. We need, I think the most, one of the really important things you say in this book is that government is the solution. It's not the problem.
Now it becomes a problem. This mm-hmm. is our problem. See, I mean, most of the countries, government is the problem.
Right.
Corruption is one.
Oh, sure.
And it's getting bigger and bigger. Corruption at every stage of governments.
Mm-hmm.
This is a common factor. They don't talk about it because it becomes so, people get so used to it as if that's part of life.
You cannot standard operating procedure.
Standard operating procedure. So, yeah. So you have to, and corruption is the one which kills the government because all the rules, procedures are mockery now. If you can buy up everything, your rules, procedures. So this is just a funny thing for the book. Somebody to study, somebody to teach in the classroom what the rules are, what the laws are. These are useless in practical purposes because you can break any rule you want. You can get anything done. Just question how much money you want to pour behind it, and people are ready to do that. So that's the way you destroy the whole idea of governance and good governance. I said we have to get back to the good governance. Well, law is a law. And if you don't like it, we change it, and so on. We proceed. Election is election. It's not a manipulation. Media is a media. It's not somebody pouring in money to change your mind and those kind of things. So all these things have to be addressed so that we can gradually go to the good governance. If we have a good governance, then all these young people who want to do things can get things done. Because if they are left to the corruption, corrupt practices, they will be puzzled. They don't know what are we going to do. Where do we begin now? So we need clean roads in our working procedures and so on, whether you want to do the trading. Trading is lots of corruption and lots of money laundering back and forth. People are accumulating all the wealth by making system work for them because they have the big money. They can make the rules work for them. No matter what is in the book, they don't care. Their wishes are the rule for the world. And that's how it will continue to have this endangering process of wealth concentration and few people getting a chance.
But I think that your vision of humanity as being mostly composed of compassion, or at least more, I think there's more of every human being is compassion and understanding than is greed and self-interest. And just by tipping the balance of the vision of humanity, we can all of a sudden begin to see, yeah, we can roll out these solutions for the poor to address all these social problems, because what we want to do is create, as you say, the social business.
Yeah. What I was emphasizing that the compassion is not something that we have to acquire from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I say I'm built with that.
Yes.
But the system has sealed it off.
Exactly.
System has put a lock on it that you never discover that your selfless part. Your only part you are supposed to expose your greedy part. So we are doing that because system locked it up. I'm trying to unlock that. I'm trying to break that lock. I said, you have it, open it up. Open the door. If you open the door, suddenly you see you have it all the time. It's not something that you have to bring it from somewhere else. You had it inside of you. Simply, your education system, your theories, your practices, they made it sure that you never discovered it. You never know that you had it. So now I'm saying, no, this, you have it. Please check it up. And once you have unleashed that, that thing will take over yourself, and because that's what you are. You design your purpose of life. You ask yourself, what is the purpose of my life? Is it to make more money, get tons and tons of money, buy up all the cars in the world or something? It doesn't make sense. What do you do with that? How many cars can you have? How many homes you can have? How many yachts can you have? It doesn't make sense. So good thing is you have the creative power, you have the energy, you have the ability. Go ahead and change the world and say, here is my signature on this planet. I was here from such and such date to such and such date, and this is what I did. And people will remember you because you did that. And everybody say, you know what? He did it. He did it in a funny way, but it worked. And the whole world changed because of that. And that's what you want to be. And you have it in you. Just be aware that you have it in you. And make sure you bring it out. That you has to be unleashed. It's not something suddenly somebody else will do that. You have to do it. You have to do it that I have the power and I'm going to use it. I will use the fullest power that I have.
The new book by Muhammad Yunus is A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon Emissions. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Yunus.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
This is Rick Kleffel. I'm the host of Narrative Species for Talk of the Bay on KSQT Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQT 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM, streaming online at ksqt.org. We just heard a discussion with Nobel Prize winner and interim Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Muhammad Yunus, about his book, A World of Three Zeros. Tune in this Friday for a conversation with Shirley Jackson Award winner Stephen Graham Jones about his new novel, I Was a Teenage Slasher. For KSQT Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQT 90.7, 89.7, and 89.5 FM, streaming online at ksqt.org, I'm Rick Kleffel.